This lecture is brought to you by Knox Theological Seminary on iTunes U. Knox is a seminary in the tradition of the Reformation that exists to educate men and women to declare and demonstrate the gospel of Jesus Christ. Our prayer is that this teaching will be beneficial in your Christian life and ministry.
The 19th century New Testament scholarship, especially Jesus scholarship, Albert Schweitzer more or less brought that to an end by discrediting it in the early years of the 20th century, showing that the real Jesus, as far as he could see, was an apocalyptic figure. Now, today, of course, we wouldn't necessarily believe that. Schweitzer's solution to the problem of Jesus would no longer be accepted. But certainly his criticism of the people that he was reacting to, that is generally accepted. You know, that the tendency we have today is to make Jesus over in our own image. This is always the danger. And in this respect, we think Schweitzer, yes, was onto something. He had a real point there. You know, we object to it, of course, as much as he did. One thing we need to consider here, particularly in relation to New Testament studies, but it sort of had a knock-on effect, really, in Old Testament eventually, was the conservative reaction. Because not everybody bought into these liberal theories. Of course, there were people who were conservative by instinct, by tradition. I'm not talking about them particularly. I'm talking about people who disagreed for academic reasons. They thought that the methods being used by these liberal scholars were faulty, that the conclusions which they were drawing were wrong, and that a different approach altogether was needed. Now, there were conservative people in Germany who opposed the liberal trends there. But they were a minority, shall we say. I'm not saying that they were unimportant or anything like that, but they were not the dominant trend. It was in the English-speaking world, more than elsewhere, that a conservative reaction, a genuinely conservative reaction to German scholarship became prominent, if not exactly dominant. And you can at least begin to understand modern biblical criticism, biblical interpretation, if you think the German tendency is on the liberal side, the English-speaking tendency is on the conservative side. There is a difference here. It's complicated, of course, by the fact that German influence in the English-speaking world, especially in the United States, has been strong from time to time and in certain places. I mean, not everywhere and not with everybody by any means, but there has been an influence of this kind, which makes it, you know, makes the picture a little bit more complex than you might otherwise it might otherwise be. But having said that, I think in general terms, you're going to get a more conservative approach in the English-speaking world. Why is this? It's not really because English-speaking people are more conservative by nature. That, you know, I don't think you could say that, really. If anything, Germans are, you know, certainly a lot more rigid in the way they approach things than we are. You know, I don't think that's the reason. I think the real reason is that the German biblical tradition, theological tradition, is dominated by philosophy and ideology. That is to say, I've already mentioned the philosophy of Hegel, you know, influencing Bauer. This is possible in Germany in a way that's hard to imagine here. I mean, if you think of biblical scholars here, whoever, I don't know who you want to pick up, but, Greg Beale or somebody like that, who writes New Testament commentaries, you don't really think of them as being particularly interested in philosophy. Philosophy is not really very central to our way of thinking. I mean, there are some people who do it, yes, but it's not part of our culture in the way that it is in Germany. And ideology, even less. We are not ideological as a people. I mean, individuals may be, but not as a people. The whole way our society is structured shows you this. You see that if you go to Germany, for instance, or any sort of European country, you'll find political parties which are constructed along philosophical or ideological lines. And some countries, they have lots of political parties, because every time you have a new philosophy or a new idea, you start a new political party. And you go on like this. But in the English-speaking world, and this is true in the United States, it's true in Canada, it's true in UK, it's true in Australia, it doesn't really matter where you are. Political parties, there are basically only two of them. I mean, there are others, but the others are minor. And you don't have much to do with them. The general pattern is that there are two. It's extremely difficult to tell how different they are from each other. I mean, they may be one of them veers sort of to the left, one of them veers to the right, but each one is so broad in itself, that it's difficult to say, who's who. And basically, and please don't feel offended by this, but I think it's absolutely true, politics is just sport on a different level. Really, I mean, because it's a team game. You see, the team A fights team B, and the basic rule of the game is you want to win, but you can't annihilate your enemy, because if you do, the game ceases. That's basically how it works. There are variations on a theme, but. Ideology, sort of like communism or something like this, doesn't really enter in to the way of thinking. People don't vote that way, they don't think that way. Europeans look at this and they say we are pragmatists. That's their word for us. And of course for them that's a dirty word, because you aren't thinking about it, you're just sort of going from one thing to the other to see what works. You see, we look at them as idealists, which for us is a dirty word, because they're just constructing new theories all the time, not actually living it out in practice. And you see the difference. France and the United States both had a revolution and devised constitutions at more or less the same time. The United States still has this constitution. France, I think, is on its 15th, something like that, 15th, 16th, who's counting, But they change every generation because the ideology changes, this kind of thing. So from our point of view, we see this as unstable. See, they look at us and think of us as unprincipled, because all we want to do is win. We don't really care what we think, as long as we win. Now, I mean, these are generalizations, but there is a truth underneath this. And in biblical interpretation, it comes out because we are less likely to be impressed by a theory like, say, early Catholicism, the development of the early Catholicism out of the freedom of the Spirit. I mean, we listen to this kind of thing and think, oh, yeah, well, what's the evidence for this? We tend to be more rooted and grounded in the text, in the actual evidence. And textual study, actually learning what the text says and working it out, is more highly developed in the English-speaking world than it is in continental Europe. It's more important, you know, commentary writing and this kind of thing. If you all you have to do is read Karl Barth's commentary on Romans, for instance, and compare it with an important English language commentary, say Cranfield's commentary on Romans, and you see the difference. Because Barth is interested in ideas, and it's basically a study of ideas, whereas Cranfield is interested in vocabulary, and it's basically a study of the meaning of words, you know, and the various possible connotations that they could have. Now, if you do this, if you're textually based, you are probably going to be more conservative because you won't change your view about what the text means because a new idea has come along. You'll want evidence that the words that you find in the text were used in this particular way by other people living at the same time. You know, you'll have a much more sort of pragmatic approach to what the text means. And in the 19th century, the opposition to German liberalism, particularly in New Testament studies, was led by people who thought like this. And there was a trio of them, famous trio, of Westcott, B.F. Westcott, Lightfoot, J.B. Lightfoot, and Hort, F.J.A. Hort. What they did was overhaul the science of textual criticism of the Bible. You see, what had happened with the New Testament? What had happened with the New Testament was that when Erasmus produced his version, you see, back in 1516, at the time of the Reformation, that gradually became the standard New Testament text, with a few modifications here and there, you know. But in 1633, a Dutch publisher produced the Latin, the Greek New Testament, and just added on the title page, Textus Receptus, received text. And this is what it's called today, the Textus Receptus. The King James Version of the Bible is based on it essentially. I mean, the name Textus Receptus came after the King James was produced, but the actual text itself was already in existence, all right? This is, you need to know this, because people today who believe that the King James Bible is the true Bible and not any of these modern newfangled versions are not just saying this because they like Old English. They're saying this because the textual tradition on which the New Testament translation is based is different from the one used by modern translations, all right? So the Textus Receptus is the text. It's sometimes called the ecclesiastical text, the Byzantine text, there are various names for it, but Textus Receptus will do for this. And these people say that this is what it should be. And there are entire societies, there's a Trinitarian Bible Society, for example, which is dedicated to upholding this tradition. And they will send you a free Greek New Testament if you ask them. But it will be this, you see, not the critical Nestle-Aland text, Bible Society text, but the Erasmian text, slightly updated, as it were. And this was the case, you see, right through, I mean, everyone who studied the New Testament, through the 18th century, were basically looking to modify this text. I mean, occasionally a verse here, a word there, you know, they would alter because they found some other evidence or things like that. But Westcott, Lightfoot, and Hort, working together as a trio, changed the method. And this is the important thing. They said, we need to scrap the Textus Receptus, the Erasmian text. this is not, you know, you can modify this as much as you like, but you're never going to get where you want to be. You know, it's like playing around with an old car or an old house or something. I mean, you can fiddle here and there, but the time comes when you're really wasting your time and you might as well just scrap the whole thing and start again, you know, and this is what they thought. But start again with what? Well, they said with manuscripts. Now, they were lucky in a way because in the 19th century, new manuscripts were being discovered. The Codex Vaticanus, for instance, lying around in the Vatican Museum. The Codex Sinaiticus, which was discovered in Mount Sinai in 1859, you know, and taken out there. It landed up, it's a very interesting history, it landed up in Russia. The Russians bought it for some reason. And then after the Russian Revolution, of course, they weren't interested in it. And so the Soviet government sold it to the British Museum in 1933 for I don't know how many million dollars, but anyway, they sold it. And now it sits in the British Museum alongside the Codex Alexandrinus, which has been there for a little bit longer. So two of the three most important biblical manuscripts are now in the British Museum. But the reason for this is, of course, that the tradition of Westcott, Lightfoot, and Hort gave high value to this sort of thing, you see. They were looking for early manuscripts. They were looking for partial manuscripts. They didn't particularly want to have complete New Testaments. I mean, if they could have them, that's fine. But they didn't confine themselves to this. If they could get a scrap of John's Gospel or a bit of, you know, Paul's letters or something like that, that was fine. And they created, really, a science of manuscript history, because by tracing errors in manuscripts, you could kind of figure out who'd copied what, you see? And they could build up sort of family trees going back to try and get the earliest common reading. And out of this, they created an artificial text. In other words, a text that does not actually exist in any given manuscript. You can't pick up a manuscript and find it written there, but which is put together by comparing all these different sources. I say artificial, the correct term for this is eclectic, meaning chosen from different places. And when you buy a Greek New Testament now, I mean a normal one, the Nestle Aland edition, this is what you are buying, all right? A text which has been reconstructed on the basis of different sources. Now, the criticism of this, of course, that could be made is to say, well, yes, but the text that we now have, that we buy, doesn't actually exist. I mean, it exists in the printed version, but there's no manuscript that corresponds to this. So how do we know it's the it's, you know, it's particularly near the original? Wouldn't it be better if you could just pick up something and say that's it? Well, yes, perhaps. But if you survey the whole field and you discover that right across the sort of traditions of manuscripts, there are certain things that keep coming back in different places, then you have a fairly good assumption that this is the original because it's common. You know, different people independently copying manuscripts without knowing the other one and so on, come up with the same thing, then this probably goes back to a common source. So although the common source isn't now available, the text is more reliable in this curious kind of way, you see. It makes, of course, textual criticism of the New Testament much more complicated than it used to be, but also much more rewarding, because you're more likely to well, you have to debate, you know, which of the readings is to be preferred, and this is not always a simple thing to do, you know. So it makes it a more exciting discipline than it used to be. However, Westcott, Lightfoot, and Hort were not doing this just for the sake of their health. They were doing this to demonstrate that Bauer's thesis was fundamentally wrong, because they thought if they could go back and produce a common text, you see, from a very early period, even though we don't actually have it, you know, the diverse evidence that is available from different sources points back in that direction, then we can question whether the theories of Bauer, you see, that say the pastoral epistles were written very late by someone who wasn't Paul and all that kind of thing, this can be shot to pieces. Because you can show that, you know, by the way the manuscripts have developed over time, by reading back, they must have been produced much earlier, initially, than Bauer believed. And this is what they did. And in particular, they compared the New Testament to other early Christian, or indeed just other contemporary Greek writings, which Bauer, funnily enough, didn't really do. Because, you see, if you take Bauer's thesis that early Catholicism developed, you know, and that everything was late, reading early Christian literature wasn't really going to tell you anything. Because you could just as easily say, you know, that the early Christian literature influenced the New Testament as the other way around. So by looking at this early Christian literature and going through it, you know, word for word and phrase for phrase, and, you know, integrating it with the New Testament and trying to see how it all fits together, these men were able to show that people writing around the year 100, Clement of Rome, Ignatius of Antioch, and so on, knew the New Testament, and that they had borrowed from it, not the other way round. You see, you can only demonstrate this by very careful word-for-word analysis and phrases, and, you know, how it's taken and what's the more likely direction of the borrowing and so on. But it's the more likely direction, because someone like Ignatius, for example, knew he was quoting the apostles and said so. You know, he didn't think of himself as an apostle. So when he comes up with phrases that, you know, you echo Paul, for instance, or one of the Gospels, you can say, well, he must have known that. You know, you can hear it in his writings. The Lord's Prayer, for example, appears in its modern form in the Didache, which is very interesting, because the Didache is very early. I mean, we don't know precisely when it was written, but, you know, it could have been 70, 80 AD. I mean, it's contemporary with maybe some of the New Testament documents. But there it is, you know, in the Didache, the Lord's Prayer written out as we say it now, including the longer ending. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory forever and ever. Amen. Which was added to Matthew's gospel later. You know, that we know. But it's in the Didache. So it must have been used in the early church, you see. I mean, the people who drop it, who leave it out because they say it's not original, well, maybe it's not original in the sense that it wasn't in Matthew's gospel originally, but it was certainly being used in Matthew's time, you know, whether it was in his text or not. So in this way, you see, these men were able to show that the New Testament is much more authentic than people like Bauer believed. You see, and it was a very painstaking thing. And to them, of course, this was the way scientific study of the Bible ought to proceed.
These courses provide a glimpse into our academic programs. Knox students can take 1 week or semester-length courses in person at our South Florida campus or choose to complete a degree entirely online. By bringing together academic excellence, a vibrant community of learning, and flexible scheduling, Knox offers today's students timeless truth through modern convenience. For more information about earning credit toward a master's degree, please visit our website at knoxseminary.edu.